Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hi, this is Dr. John back with the Evolved Caveman podcast, and I am saying thank God because the last time we did this interview, I failed to hit record. And then that's the second time I've done that. So I want to say a big thank you to Alan for coming back. Always have great conversations with Alan. So let me do a quick intro. So Alan Samuel Cohen, MBA, PCC, is an experienced executive and team coach, corporate instructor, TEDx speaker, and author with over a decade of experience coaching leaders and teams at companies such as MetLife, American Express, Skadden Arps, Tiffany's NBC, and countless PR and marketing agencies. He also leads a community of heart-centered male coaches who are interested in emotional intelligence and professional development. He resides in Manhattan and Miami with his spouse and their three-legged Wheaton Terrier. Thank you, Alan. How are you?
I'm great. I am great.
And remind me of the name of the dog again.
The dog is Bueller.
Bueller, Ferris Bueller. That's right.
Every day is a day off.
Yes. Excellent. A great name. So tell me, let's start off by talking about a story of you at your very best, which, you know, typically starts with struggle and then ends up with something that you've learned along the way.
Sure. So I guess it's now about 15 years ago. If you looked at me from words, Alan. If you looked at me, you would see a guy who had his shit completely together.
From the outside.
That was the word I was searching for, John.
Outside.
Great job, great spouse, great life, two homes, like all of the creature comforts, you know, upper middle class, white, you know, privileged, all that stuff. But behind the scenes, things were not so great. I was sporting a pretty serious drug habit. I was getting into serious drugs. So, you know, crystal meth being really the thing that ultimately brought me to my knees. And, and there was an evening where it just all got to be too much. And I was actually using with a buddy of mine who I'd used with before in some shithole hotel, and he had stopped using, but I kept on going and going, and I had this moment of just despair where, like, I couldn't put anything else in me, that nothing was making me happier. It wasn't working, and he asked me if I wanted some help, and I had never accepted help at any time before that. I mean, with my spouse, you know, told me he was going to send me the, you know, to rehab if I didn't stop, you know. I mean, that wasn't help. I just kept on using. But that, for some reason that night, you know, sort of like a divine light or something, I don't know, I said yes.
Can I pause you there for a second, Alan? Because it makes me think of the man box culture, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, but how we're socialized to be self-reliant. Yeah. So all the men I've talked to suck, including myself, at asking for help or accepting help. Our internal response is, I don't need any help.
Yeah, it has to get pretty, pretty dark for me. I usually try to figure it out on my own, fix it myself.
And so maybe a lesson there is for all of us to be a little bit more open to receiving help.
Yeah, because that in that moment, my life changed. I mean, he brought me to my first 12-step meeting. I didn't realize at the time he was also trying to get sober. I've had more success than him. I've stayed in touch with him all these years. But he would be the last person you would expect to be that person to deliver you to a 12-step meeting. You know, he was a party boy.
So pardon me for interrupting again. So tell me your experience of first going to, was it AA or NA, but a 12-step meeting?
It was actually Crystal Meth Anonymous.
You know, I didn't even realize they have that.
I went right to the senior class.
Wow.
You know, I bypassed, you know, freshman, you know, marijuana.
Yeah, you went to advanced NA or advanced AA.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, nobody had any teeth. It was pretty, you know, it's not true. I mean, it was a lot of guys like me, you know, who weren't being kind to themselves.
I've coached a lot of people to get into 12-step programs. Yeah. And part of the difficulty, I think, is the discomfort that you feel walking into that first meeting, maybe the first few meetings.
Yeah. so and I share this story about the need to be hugged, right? That's a craving that I've had like all of my life. You know, my dad never or rarely hugged me. I had to like kind of teach him how to hug me. I never saw him be intimate with
me
mom.
Too.
Hard, right? It's a hard thing to know and to see. But at this first meeting, there's this guy who's like 6'4". His name was John, Big John, they called him. And Big John was the hugger, the meeting hugger. So you'd walk in the room and here's this guy, who's a great looking guy, you know, and I'm a gay man. I respond well to that, you know, big like lumberjack kind of guy. And he's like, do you want a hug? And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll take a hug. Right. And I automatically felt like, I felt comforted and I walked into the room and then I looked around and I saw all these faces and some people I actually knew from my running days.
Wow.
So it was largely a gay meeting. So I felt even more at home.
How did you find a meeting that specific?
There are gay men,
crystal meth addicts. I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, it's New York City, right? Something.
Okay. Okay. So that's gay, perfect for you.
Yeah. A gay crystal meth anonymous meeting, but everybody is welcome, but it was mainly men, mainly gay.
GCMA. Okay.
Yeah. It's, and I think they're in many cities and, some women and the straight gay, I mean, it's very inclusive group. But I remember like the first time, you know, when you're asked to identify yourself as, you know, and so saying, my name is Alan, I'm an addict was like, I mean, those were words that had never come out of my mouth before. And once I said it, it was like, oh shit, like I am. Like I just said it because I just thought everybody else was saying it. But then
Did you believe it at first?
Oh.
Because a lot of clients that I've talked to, they really wrestle with that self-label.
Not at first. Especially because, you know, I ran with a bunch of, of guys who were big party boys and none of them were, my intimate circle.
Right.
So I always thought that it was kind of normal. We were just like guys that like to have a lot of fun. But in time, I came to realize just how addicted I am. And I still struggle with addiction. I don't use recklessly, you know, I'm not completely abstinent. But I stay away from the things that nearly killed me.
The heavier things.
And that seems to work. But it was the first time in my life where I really accepted that there was something greater than myself, that I would actually have to accept that there was something greater than myself, greater than drugs.
What did you accept, if I can ask? Like, what? What's your belief?
Yeah. Well, they talk about a higher power. I was raised modern Orthodox or conservative Jewish, so I kind of didn't embrace that because I didn't feel like I was embraced as a gay man. But I believed in, and I still do to this day, that there is power in connection. There is something about something that happens when people get together and kind of hold each other and care for each other and care about each other and make it more about any individual, more about the group.
The reason I ask is I think there's something fundamentally important about that relationship to something bigger than yourself.
Yeah.
And it could be energy that permeates all things. It can be, belief in some sort of vague, nebulous higher power. It could be a man sitting on a cloud. But I think that it's important to have some belief in something larger than yourself, because when we make it all about ourselves, it undermines our happiness.
Yeah.
I would say we need that connection to something larger. And it could be like a volunteer. Like if you have a mission to help out a group of people or fight a disease, like that's great too. But to make it about something other than yourself is really important.
And I think it changes, at least for me, it has changed.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Higher power is, it's changed for me over time.
Yeah.
But I definitely have faith that there's something that guides me, that keeps me on.
Does Judaism believe in a God per se?
Yeah.
Okay. So did you get angry at God when you came out, or was there times when you were?
No. I got angry at God when I got, like a year into sobriety.
Why then?
I remember actually being on a trip to San Francisco and I was alone, staying in a nice hotel. It was business, I guess. And I was like, shit, like I can't do any of the things that I used to do that I enjoyed doing.
Fun.
Yeah. And I remember like, this is crazy, but I remember actually getting on the floor, like on my knees and like pounding my fists. Yeah. Like, can I curse on this show? Like,
yeah, please.
I was just so enraged. It was like, great. Like you've given me this life and I'm bored, you know, and I want to do what I want to do.
Yeah. And the reason I asked that question, thank you for sharing all this. I really appreciate it is I think it's a really normal reaction at times in our lives, if you believe in a higher power, to get mad at that higher power. And nobody seems to want to talk about that.
Yeah,
like everyone's like, oh, that's, you know, that makes me nervous. Yeah. But I think it's critically important to give people permission to be angry at God, because I think it's a normal emotional reaction.
Well, to be angry at God, and I guess also and we talked about this the other day, you know, my dad being very progressive, educated, intellectual, with a very strong Jewish center, you know, always questions everything. So he's like, you know, I've never seen him like really be angry at God, but I've seen him really, really question, like, where is God? Like, and he'll ask that right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the world, you don't see people angry at God. You know what I mean? Like, to me, anger at God is something you do in your bedroom when no one's looking, right? Or, you know, when you're just broken and distraught, or something really tragic has happened and there's no human to blame. Cancer, sudden infant death syndrome. Yeah. And I just think it's really important to give people permission to be angry at God and to work on forgiving God for allowing certain things to happen.
Yeah.
Because that's just a normal human reaction.
I love it. And I actually, in this conversation, I haven't really thought about it before. You know, I've questioned God. I've wondered sort of, where is he right now? You know, what's the plan? You know, why are you letting us struggle so much? All those kind of more the philosophical, spiritual kinds of questions, but never actually allow myself to get them.
Sometimes I like believing in, you remember Conan the Barbarian? Sure. It was like a comic book and a novel series, but he had this god called Crom, and he would always kind of get angry and rage at Crom, but Crom was simply like an observer. So he was up there just kind of watching us, never getting involved.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of how I look at my God, my higher power. But, you know, because I don't think like, you know, it always makes me laugh when people like pray before a football game.
Yeah.
You know, how arrogant, like you think God really is going to come down and like make your team win?
Yeah.
I don't know. I always thought that was kind of odd to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It is kind of funny.
I mean, I just don't think that God kind of has that active of a hand in our lives.
Right. It's like, it's also, you know, and like in 12 step that, you know, you talk about is like really asking for God's will. Like what's your will? Like, what lead me where you want me to go, you know, but it's not like saying like, I want that contract.
Yeah.
If you don't give me that contract, I am going to be very, very mad at you.
Well, and I do pray at times, and I think I used to pray from a position of lack. God, give me the courage. God, help me, you know, I don't know, get this contract or whatever it was. Give me the wisdom. But now the only way I pray is simply gratitude.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for my fiance. Thank you for my children. Thank you for, you know, a prosperous life. Thank you for the ability to walk on my own, which at times has been debatable.
Yeah. Well, gratitude has such a high vibration.
Yeah.
Like in the hierarchy of emotions, it's like one of the most positive emotions we can.
Yeah. And you know what, there was, I forget who it was, but a book I read many, many years ago had emotions in terms of vibrational level kind of laid out, with anger at the bottom, maybe sadness at the bottom, anger, and then it kind of went up. And I don't think it's that linear, but I do like thinking about emotions as kind of vibration or energy.
Yeah. Well, I love that sort of, we could talk, you know, for hours about anything, but gratitude is certainly, like, I don't think that I was a terribly grateful person until I first discovered 12-step programs.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because I realized also just how fortunate I was to have the gift of desperation, you know, because I'd be dead otherwise.
Yes.
I know I would be dead. So I
am. Yeah, and thank God you're still alive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know we didn't sort of put a conclusion to the story, but, you know, where I'm sort of at my best is frankly, it's when I am in service of other people. I think that that's what I got from 12-step, you know, being sponsored, being a sponsor, indirectly led me into being a coach, helping others, mentoring people. If I'm not serving, I'm not thriving. And, which is also in ways like why I've been feeling so as crappy as the past few months have been in the world, and I don't know when this will air, but it's probably still crappy. the opportunity to step up and serve has been profound. It's probably one of the first times in many years where in the morning I wake up and I know, like, there are people who are counting on me to, to help, to serve, to be a voice, whatever it is. And that feels really good.
Well, that's so huge to have that purpose when you wake up. It's funny because I was actually thanking God that you're still alive. I mean, I really gravitate towards your energy. I enjoy our conversations in a big way. And so, yeah, I'm thankful you didn't die in a terrible drug death.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I'll remember that.
All right. So let's talk a little bit more about emotional intelligence, because you coach leaders and clients around and teams around emotional intelligence. Why should we give a shit about emotional intelligence?
Yeah, I am of the mind that most everything that we want in our life that we have or that we don't have is related to how emotionally intelligent we are. We've talked about this before. Yeah. That the heart of emotional intelligence is our ability to connect to ourselves and to others. And so I think that while people, there's still people out there who see EQ as like a set of, quote unquote, soft skills. Mm-hmm. I think there's soft skills that are very difficult to enact on a consistent basis. And, there are people out there who think that they're highly emotionally intelligent and they may have a blind spot because there may be certain aspects of their EQ, whether it's they're too assertive or they're lacking empathy or it's not as high as it could be or whatever it is that could benefit from doing the work that I do with leaders and men in particular. So I don't think there's anything soft about it because it's really. And even recently there was a statistic by the World Economic Forum that said that the skills that comprise emotional intelligence are among the top 10 or something.
I see that over and over where big companies are looking for these quote soft skills. I think the soft skills label is a terrible label because it's kind of a put down in a way. But I've also heard the argument that these are the most important skills that young people can pick up because in the future, as we head further and further into the future, more of the jobs that can be reduced to an algorithm or a set of steps will be automated. So they'll be done by robot or computer. And, what do we have beyond a robot or a computer is emotion, empathy, communication, listening, creativity is a big one.
Yeah.
And, just that understanding that you got to be in a positive emotional space to enhance your creativity, that's a big thought.
Yeah. Well, and I think, what's led me, and maybe this was a follow-up question, but, I think I was led to do this work in part because I've always been very emotionally expressive. Even as a kid, I used to get feedback that I was highly creative, but needed to exercise self-control. like a little of me was enough or too much. And I got that message that being emotionally expressive, being a firecracker, it's more than people can handle. So I for a long time I dialed it back and I kind of suppressed it and played the game, and I have found that there's so much freedom in really unlocking my emotions and I'll cry at the drop of a hat now, and I'll laugh and I'll yell and it's really it's such a great release and it has allowed me to have deeper relationships with people.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I've had clients tell me you have a very emotionally expressive face. Okay. Yeah. But when I'm with clients, I'm often very expressive because I'm trying to model it for them. I'll often do really stupid and crazy like demonstrations in an attempt to make them laugh because I think laughter is so important. Yeah. And one of the things that I really focused on for a couple of years is being quick and easy to laugh and smile because I think as a man, it's easy to do this, you know, you just, the resting bitch face, or, you know, that blank face that you think is neutral, but most people would interpret that as negative, I would say. Yeah. A little bit angry, a little bit irritated, a little bit stressed, tired, whatever it is.
I have the emotionally expressive face too.
Yeah.
So, you know, play poker with me if you want to just, you know.
Oh, I love playing poker and trying to pick up micro expressions. That's awesome.
No, but it's easy to tell if I have a winning hand. So, you know.
So let me ask you this. So it sounds to me like you were told at a younger age that you were very expressive and maybe a little bit too much emotionally. And that to me fits with the gay stereotype. Yeah. So then do you dial it back and act more straight? Is that accurate?
Yeah. So I, you know, I was very afraid of being outed in high school, and college as well. And so, not that I'm a flamboyant person, but I think I kind of tamped down some of my expressiveness to fit, to fit in, to pass. Right. Yeah. In college, I even I dated women just so people would leave me alone.
Yeah.
So I led this kind of like secret life, but yeah.
And so how does that impact you? Like leading the second life, that separate or second life?
It was hard, you know, it was hard to not feel like I could trust my friends, especially in college, and also to some extent my friends in high school. So I didn't come out to any of my friends in high school until I was probably a senior, maybe even until I was a freshman in college. Mm-hmm. But that I didn't I didn't trust the relationships enough, and that there was I had some shame. Well, I had a good amount of shame, you know, that there was something wrong with me. I always knew there was something different about me, but based on my parents who, you know, did their best. I mean, I still definitely knew that if they had their preference, I wouldn't have this preference. And, you know, even to where it's like, when I came out to them, I told them I was bisexual and true. And every time I would talk to them, I would tell them, I've moved a little bit more toward men only. now they're good about it. You know, how many 40 years later, they're good about it.
So you were 20 when you came out to your parents?
I was, in my early 20s.
Yeah. How scary was that for you?
So it was crazy. It was crazy. My timing was so crazy too, because I guess it was right after college and I was maybe living home for a little bit. And I told my parents that I was gay when I was living home with them, which meant that you're just like, it would be one thing to tell your parents on a weekend visit and then you could leave. But I my parents ran up to my bedroom, closed the door and let them, deal. I think my way was just sort of drop it in their lap and then not talk about it again. Mm. And, or every time my mother would bring it up, I would stop the conversation. And she also asked me stupid questions. When did you know something we did?
Okay.
Is so-and-so gay? She'd ask me about all these people that she knew.
Oh, let me ask you a question. Cause I've dealt with, gay men in high school. Mm-hmm. And often from different cultures, like Indian, where there's a big problem between the parents who are more traditional and the son. And one of the big sources of contention is homosexuality genetic, or is it learned? Do you get it? Do you pick it up from the environment?
Right. Right. Nature nurture. Right.
Right.
I don't have the science there, to back me up, but my sense is that it's maybe more nature than nurture.
Yeah. Do you think it's a combination?
I guess not. I mean, I guess think if you're gay, it's genetic. Uh-huh. I don't know. Has that been proven? I don't know.
No, it hasn't been proven because I've looked. I mean, I think it's way, way far on the genetic side.
Mm-hmm.
Like 90, 95, 98%.
Right, right.
Because I don't think it's a choice.
Because if you were born into a family where like everybody was gay and they're like, hey, like John, be gay. Like we would love it if you would be gay. Yeah. Like if you're not gay, you're going to be like, eh, I don't, like that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Like
you would try it for a while. Right. And then
it wouldn't work. It's like, I can't like vanilla ice cream. Yeah. It's like, I just, there's nothing. You could tell me I have to like it, but I'm just not going to like it. And,
but it's interesting that very belief about, homosexuality is genetic versus, you know, nature versus nurture, that belief, is associated with a lot of homophobia. Mm. If you believe that it's a choice, that group of people is far more likely to be homophobic.
Right.
Right. Which I found that to be pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, I haven't experienced a ton of like, and I have been fortunate, right? I haven't had like the slurs directed at me and all of that. But I'm part of a system and I'm part of a world and a culture that, you know, that is largely homophobic or, you know, more hetero, embracing. So I guess. Go ahead.
Did you get much of the man box culture when you were growing up in middle school and high school? You know, where you get, you know, don't be a girl, don't be a bitch, don't be a pussy. And on the other side, don't be gay, don't be a fag.
I was really very, very fortunate that I'm, you know, so my brother, my older brother, you know, was a total jock.
Okay.
Basketball, you know, champ, like really just good at every kind of sport, dated lots of girls and all that. And, you know, he would be like playing with G.I. Joes and all that stuff. And I would be playing with Barbie dolls, like across the, you know, with my best girlfriend, neighbor. And my parents never said anything like, to discourage me about that. My brother couldn't stand me. I mean, you know, he didn't want anything to do with me, but I never got messages from my parents anyway, that like, I have to be like, my father, you know, tried to see if I would like sports, but once right. I didn't, he was like, go to pottery school. If that's what you want, whatever you want.
Well, and I think we often don't get those messages at home. I mean, I think some people do from, you know, a dad or bigger brother, but oftentimes it's from acquaintances, friends, and peers out, you know, at school generally.
Not so much that I'm aware of. I did get bullied in high school, or I guess in junior high school, but it wasn't overtly, it wasn't like a gay attack. It was an attack that I had so many female friends. So I guess there was a mocking.
Yeah.
That feminized me because I had so many female friends. And that was very scary for me and very confronting and very hurtful.
Yeah, traumatic.
And the first man that I ever slept with, I was in high school. And I was a freshman and he was an upperclassman. He was very, very out. And he was very, very flamboyant and a lot of feminine energy. And I was terrified that he would out me for like an entire year. I was afraid.
Were you able to tell him, I don't want to be outed? Or did you just, like, it wasn't discussed?
I think I just asked him not to, but I didn't trust that he would honor. Yeah. The same thing happened to me in college. Interestingly too, I slept with someone when I was an upperclassman. He was a freshman. And I didn't realize after I slept with him that he was head of the gay student union. And I was totally in the closet. And I was like, oh my God. I'm like, what have I done? Good, but he didn't out me. At least, but you know what? I used to get these weird phone calls late at night at college saying, "I know what you are, and I'm good." You know,
wow.
Like your secret's not safe.
Oh, so, that's terrible.
It was like a bad like slasher.
That's constant anxiety.
Yeah, and you know what? It didn't stop me from being a lurker. Like I would even go like. I would like hide in the bushes outside of like the student union where they would have the gay student meetings. I would just like hide in the bushes to see who was going in and going out. So for months I was doing that because I thought I'm not alone, right? But who else is? So I was like just in the shadows. And then you know, much later on, I found out that I was at the wrong entrance.
Huh.
And There's a bad joke in there somewhere.
There's somewhere. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I can see a couple right now. But the other thing, well, the other thing that strikes me is there's a, and men are going to be upset at this, but there's a big parallel to me between what you went through and what straight men go through. I think in the terms of everyone's wearing masks.
Yeah.
Everyone's got secrets that they don't want to divulge. And to me, I mean, for straight men as well as gay men, it's often emotional that we feel, you know, we have these emotions we're like ashamed of, you know, you get depressed or you get anxious and scared and you're like, oh shit, I'm not supposed to feel that. Or that just, I feel things deeply. I mean, that was, you know, mine kind of growing up. It was like
high school was probably the worst for me. Because I really was leading like a double life, like, cause I lived right outside of Manhattan. I would go to Manhattan. I would like play around with men and come home. Like, I was just like, I felt so cheap, so dirty. And like, cause I knew that my parents would disapprove.
Yeah.
It was hard, you know, it's hard to live a secret.
Well, and I've talked to a lot of young men that are in that same spot that will, you know, go from here to San Francisco at night. And, you know, hook up, I don't know, one was hooking up with furry parties or furry groups. It gets a little bit dangerous. I mean, like, I would worry about physical safety and STDs.
Sort of a message out there to the, you know, if there are people listening, you know, younger, figuring out, coming out. Like, it's so much better now than it was.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I remember, like, going down to my basement of my apartment and, like, getting on, like, a phone line, you know, that my parents couldn't access, and like not calling like for sexual partners, but like calling like gay helplines and stuff like that. Cause I wanted to know what was wrong with me. Like, and I wanted resources. Cause you know, like I recalled in college, there was something wrong with me when I like went to one of my counselors, you know, that was really screwed up.
But that's a tough question. What's wrong with me? I mean, that's a hard one to sit with because there was nothing wrong with you. I mean,
but I felt like there was something.
Sure. I get it. Yeah. But that's that would take a few years for me to answer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, you know, we're not even getting into this, but then, you know, it's like, then, you know, come the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, I buried 30 of my friends, you know, to, you know, AIDS and, you know, so, you know, then it's like, you know, now you've got like all of the news media making it wrong. You know, it's a gay
thing. Yeah. AIDS shaming.
More shame, more shame, more shame, more shame.
So, was that mostly AIDS and HIV?
Yeah. All AIDS.
All. Wow. Holy shit. Yeah. And then you've got this emotional weight that you carry too, the grieving, the depression, the sadness. Yeah. That's a lot of.
But I remember, you know, it's something to remember this. I mean, I come out to my parents, so this was maybe a couple of years later, I told them that one of my best friends had died or was dying, you know, AIDS-related brain cancer, and my parents were incredible. I mean, they were just incredible. And I was, you know, and I remember my mother and my father saying, we've lost friends in our lives, but we have no idea what it must be like for you to be losing friends who are as young as you are.
Yeah.
And I just felt so much empathy and love and support. So it's the beginning of healing acceptance.
And so when did you start to feel comfortable with your identity and merge those two lives into one?
Yesterday, last week.
Congratulations.
It's ever since I met you,
John. Well, but you're here talking about it quite openly. So, I mean, to me, that's a taking off the mask that I really appreciate.
Yeah. I would say, you know, I've been with my spouse 31 years. So I think one of the first times where I felt, you know, it was basically when we started dating and I told him all the horrible, you know, horrible things that I had done in my past, and you know, and he didn't run, you know, and I think that was the beginning. And then just like being, you know, having a relationship where you're bringing each other home to meet your parents, and like it, you know, and there's acceptance and in that, and you know, and getting married, Yeah. I mean, you know, that's what we got married maybe 10 years ago, I guess, in the state of New York. You know, being in a room with, now I'm going to cry, you bastard.
You know, yes.
In a room with 50 people, your closest family members, your cousins, your some of your gay friends, and, you know, just back to that hug, right? I was talking about earlier, feeling like you were being hugged by this community of love and support. And I remember that day as though it were yesterday. Barry's mother was dying, I remember, and she couldn't come to the wedding. And I remember it was the first time that I actually saw him cry, because he's very stoic, you know, crying because he wanted her to be there. He wanted to share the happiness with her. And, you know, I think that that's something that I think gay men for a long time have struggled with, that they haven't felt like, you know, they had the access to some of the same wonderful opportunities as their heterosexual friends, you know,
yeah,
to be
ritual. Yeah.
And it was beautiful, you know, traditional Jewish wedding. And, you know, we both broke the glass and, you know, and our, you know, our relationship isn't perfect, but every day we're learning more about each other and respecting each other and growing old together, which is, you know, pretty damn nice. I try not to screw it up too bad, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. And I love, there's this big idea to me of being able to share your whole story with someone, like all your dark parts, right, all the shadow, and they go, yeah. So, yeah. Or they go, yeah, I love you in spite of all that.
Exactly. Bring it, like, bring it on.
And,
like,
and then there's the exhale.
Right. And then you're like, oh shit. Right.
Yeah. Well, then it becomes scary, right? I mean, then, you know, then you're in a relationship, and that's where I think the real work begins.
But then you still have to test it a little bit.
I fucked up again, honey. Sorry.
Okay, all right.
But yeah, I appreciate you sharing all that, because I think that, I'm kind of stuck on that man box culture idea and the masks that we all wear, and that unites us. And if I can take a moment, for my story, because I'm still struggling with this. So I've met so many men that are wearing masks that are feeling pain and disconnection underneath. And I met this guy who was like 62, great guy, successful, and yet very disconnected. No wife, no spouse, no partner, no kids. Would have relationships, but none kind of stuck. And the coronavirus shelter in place thing really, really got to him. And he ended up shooting himself yesterday. And so, you know, RIP, Steve. And it breaks my heart. And for some reason, my mind went from Steve to all men, because I think that, you know, one of the challenges for us is to evolve out of that man box. And at times, at least with certain people, to be able to take your masks off and say, this is who I am, is so important, because those secrets, that shadow can kill us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So thank you for allowing me to share.
Well,
he's been on my mind.
Yeah, well, peace to your friend. And the depression and anxiety exacerbated by shelter in place and, you know, feeling like you're not entitled to have those feelings that are so completely...
Yeah, and loneliness, is a big one.
Yeah, it's heart-achingly sad.
Yeah. So let's try and segue from there to emotional intelligence and talk a little bit about sort of the tenets of emotional intelligence. So what are some of the things you teach to men? What are some of the things you notice when you're first starting working with men?
Yeah. So, you know, beyond the usually the people that work with me, certainly in corporate, it has been highly recommended that they work with me, because something in the feedback is suggesting that they need to have greater connection to some aspect of their emotional intelligence. With the men, it tends to be that they need to have greater empathy and deepen their interpersonal relationships. Mm. It's rarely, you know, because they're not meeting goals and objectives and, you know, and getting things done on time. And sometimes it's, you know, it's because they're overly assertive, bordering on aggressive, which can pair nicely in the cocktail, right? Low empathy. Sometimes it's because, you know, it's how they act under stress. So, you know, we've talked about this before, that, you know, guys who sort of wear the stress and the overwhelm like a badge of honor. So, you know, they just, it's like motivated by ego and attention, trying to, you know, so helping them, you know, whether it's delegating more or, you know, just taking more, you know, bringing more mindfulness to the corporate environment. That's,
yeah, I think awareness is the first step often. So mindfulness becomes the first step.
I mean, you know, with men in particular, even more so than the women that I coach, you know, it's always sort of inside out, outside in work, because you can't just say, well, we're just going to work on your listening skills like that. You know, it has to, because like, you know, how is listening better going to impact your productivity, team dynamics and their results? You know, overall effectiveness, et cetera. So it's like, you know, they always want to have, you know, some kind of metrics to put more creativity, more collaboration.
So going back to the empathy one, the empathy one's a big one to me, because the people that worry me the most in this world are the people that are really low in empathy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you teach more empathy?
Sure. Well. So empathy is like any aspect of EQ. It's a muscle that can be built. You know, some people are more, you know, have flexed it more. They've developed it more. Some of that is conditioning, social messages. Some of it is you know, what you've been rewarded for. It's like, if you've been rewarded for being an empathetic leader, you'll be a more empathetic leader. But anybody can build in any of these areas. So we, you know, first it's obviously the awareness. It's like, you know, sometimes it's providing them feedback from how other people see them in terms of empathy. So I use an EQ assessment tool, which is also a 360. So people can reflect. And then usually the coachee will take that information in and not understand it and resist it and, you know, and deflect it. But ultimately, if they're open to it, they, you know, we go to the emotional gym, right? It's like, you know, so this week you're going to ask more questions. You're going to work on, you know, you're going to journal on it. You're going to, you know, start labeling emotions in yourself so you can better label emotions in others. You're going to practice saying, you know, 10 times this week, it sounds like you feel blank because X, Y, Z happened. It's, you know, maybe watching some movies and, you know, and just like where it's safe to like, how would you empathize with that character? Like how, you know, what would things look like if you were in his shoes based on his experience, his assumptions, his DNA, whatever it is. So, you know, it's, as I said, it's like going to the gym, right? We just gotta like, we strengthen that muscle.
Do you find that you get much like resistance from narcissists? I figure that's about, you know, 6 to 10% of the population.
Yeah, and I would say that I don't coach narcissists. Maybe if I really want to be, you know, of service, I would take some of those people on. But I find some of those people are just uncoachable in that moment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't, I like a challenge, but, you know, sometimes that might even border more on like a psychological or psychiatric issue. And
They're just hard to coach because they're resistant. But the other.
Can I be political though?
Please.
If somebody asked me to coach Donald Trump, I would love a few hours with him. Freaking love. If there's anybody out there who can get me an hour coaching session with Donald Trump, I would love it.
I would love for you to do that. But kind of one last thing. One of the last things though is, I keep thinking of this. There's this quote from Bradley Whitford who acts on The West Wing. And he says, anytime I get criticism from the director, I go through three stages internally. There's fuck you. I suck. Wait, what? And I love that because like every, like even the leaders you're dealing with, they go through the same thing. Like there's anger externalized, there's anger internalized. And then if you get past those two stages, you're like, maybe there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know what, so I've been doing this as I probably as long as you, now I just really trust, like if I stay in the process, they'll get there. Mm-hmm. And I no longer like get into the box with them. Like I just, like I'm able to sort of maintain that like detached involvement and the helicopter view. It's like, you're just being that, doing that human thing. Right. So like, just trust the process, stay with it. And usually there'll be a shift, you know, but I also find there always has to be the what's in it for them, you know? So if it's just like their boss saying they need it, they're not nearly as bought in as if they see how it's going to directly help them in their career.
Absolutely.
To connect with it.
So let me wrap up just by asking, where can people get a hold of you on social media?
Sure. I'm clever here. Everything is Alan Samuel Cohen. So it's AlanSamuelCohen.com. On Twitter, it's Alan Samuel Cohen. On Instagram, it's Alan Samuel Cohen. On Facebook, it's Alan Samuel Cohen. Alan Samuel Cohen.
That is very consistent branding.
Isn't that nice?
Well done.
Thank you, sir.
You must have like a marketing and PR background.
It's called a mother and a father. They gave me a name and I'm sticking with it.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for joining me. As always, I love our conversations. And that was quite an emotional roller coaster on that one.
I love it.
We were all over the place.
Inside out, as they say.
Well, thanks again. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Please be sure to like, share, and rate.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.